So these stories, these religions, these hierarchical, patriarchal religions that we're practicing are actually racist religions. And so patriarchy has created race, but it's so intertwined that you can't really have one without the other. So, you know, that's the backgrounds. But in truth, I've developed the background from the book into, you know, understanding how race manifests. And if you look at those ways of behaving and acting, you see the similarities with capitalism and so on. So really what it is it's a cultural orientation. We all are human beings. We all are genetically human beings. And our differences are not genetic in the sense that Black people at the bottom of this human hierarchy are the most inferior. All that is rubbish.
This podcast came to be because I want to reignite discussions about Pan-Africanism. And the purpose is to plant seeds of unity and inspiration among Africans, both at home and in the diaspora. I believe we have come to the stage where our continent is more vulnerable than ever. And it's up to us to decide our fate moving forward. What we will come to realize, I hope, is that we're so much more alike than we're different. And this show is just a small contribution to the public discourse that is going on in Africa right now. My name is Soshima Iro, and this is the Pan-African Experience. The following episode is a conversation with Dr. Nat Dove. We talked about her book, African Mothers, Bearers of Culture, Makers of Social Change. Dr. Nat Dove is an author, lecturer, and scholar in African American studies. She has lived in Ghana, Nigeria, Sierra Leone, Canada, and the United Kingdom. Now in the US, she is the assistant professor in the Department of Africology and African American Studies at the College of Liberal Arts, Temple University in Philadelphia. Her research focuses on African culture, First Nations people in the United States, Black women, and education. I am grateful and honored to have Dr. Dove on the podcast. Dr. Nat Dove, welcome to the Pan-African Experience.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm very honored. Thank you.
Okay, you know, the current world order is defined by European-centered interpretation of reality. You know, mm-hmm. A reality where some members of humanity have assumed the right to control the resources of others. You know, your research and your body of work has been in opposition to this current world order. And this is reflected in your book, African Mothers, Bearers of Culture, Makers of Change. I actually have the book with me here. Your book, you know, the said African Mothers are the Bearers of Culture, Makers of Social Change. Can you elaborate on that exactly for, you know, someone that is outside this concept? How so?
Yeah, I've really spoken a lot outside the book, you know, because I've spoken a lot about the things that I've learned since I wrote the book, because it's 20-something years old.
Yeah.
But I have the roots, the source of the later determinations that I've made. So it doesn't really take away. I'm still using Diop and an African way of looking at things. And what I've done is in the book is to bring mothers together who may not even be considered to be African in some ways or others. You know, people like myself. And that's why, you know, my own experience was really a very important part of this book, because my formative years were in Ghana and Nigeria. So it meant that when I came to the UK and went to school in the UK, I could see the madness of what was being said. I can't say that for children who were born in the UK and had to believe the story, but I came from the real thing, and so I knew that the story was wrong. I also had a European mother and an African father. And so when I was growing up, I was seen to be the product of a sort of hybrid devil makeup, a forbidden union between the one race and the other race. And so people were against my existence because of the coming together of these races, which shouldn't be breeding. And, you know, living in that kind of atmosphere where you're despised because you're a product of these breedings is a very strange place to be. And you know that, you know, in my case, you know, I had a father who was a brilliant thinker and a mother who was who also was a brilliant thinker, even though she came from a poor family. It was a family of people that all were sort of socialistic in their tendencies. And, you know, so my father should have been hanging off a tree as a monkey. And my mother was a prostitute because she came together with a monkey. So all these things in my head were ludicrous. You know, it challenged, you know, my whole family challenged all the ideas that were being perpetrated and given to us. So I really, writing this book was part of proving, in a way, that you can be African in your thinking and behavior, and culturally so, whatever you look like, if you believe in that culture, if you see the beauty of that culture, if you want to participate in that culture. So I had to realistically step outside the race paradigm. So, because it didn't make any sense, but then, you know, evidence showed that it's absolutely true. We are not races, we're phenotypes, which enables me to think, you know, well, I was onto something because I didn't believe what was said. So I was always a rebel. People, you know, at school, I hated the way that I was treated and looked at, you know, but people can't believe that, you know. They think, well, you're light-skinned, they must have loved you, but they didn't, because it was a forbidden union at that particular time that I was in it.
You know, your book, you know, this book looks at the hair stories of 21 African mothers from Caribbean, Africa, United Kingdom, and United States. You said that the analysis of their narrative is guided by the questions that shaped this book, your book, African Mothers. You know, so I want us to go through a few of these questions in the context of these hair stories. One of the questions is just, How were Europeans able to take institutional control of the world's peoples and resources?
Well, I do use enslavement as a part of this background that the mother's ancestors have gone through. But essentially it is one of murder and conquest, you know, which comes out of the Northern Cradle and the development of the doctrine of white supremacy. But essentially, it is just clash of cultures in a way. One is searching, will defend itself, but is always searching for higher learning. And this is viewed as a weakness for those who want to take what they want when they want it, and so on. So it's a clash of cultures in that way. One is aggressive and the other one works towards more peaceful means, but if necessary can, you know, defend. It's mostly been that way, but it's murder until people acquiesce to the conqueror. So, you know, and it has been across the whole of Africa, whether it has been from the Islamic end or the Christian end, or the European end, or the, you know, or the Arabic end. The whole of Africa has been taken over using similar methods of, if you don't do this, you die. So, you know, it's been responsible. The people who survived this were the people who had to live, to have children, to carry on, and took that idea that in the future we can change all this.
Okay, and this same dynamic, the world order, it has continued till today, right? Would you say so?
Yes, I would say so, because, you know, during the time of decolonization, if you like, we have already had the governments and all the, this is an important part of Job's theory, is that when you, the culture is that institutions are the foundations, they are the pillars of culture. So every institution that is developed is upholding the culture so it reifies, it reflects the cultural values and beliefs. So what has happened is that through domination, the imposition of cultural values and beliefs and the changing of institutions, which led to the erosion of African institutions, so the changing into the European or Arabic institutions has maintained the culture. So it's a way of thinking as well, you know, the cultural culture is imposed upon our minds, and how we behave is reflective of our minds, of our thinking. And these institutions reflect the culture that has developed them. So we're inside institutions that literally despise Black humanity, African humanity, you know, and we tweak them to kind of make them work for us, but they're anti-African. And, you know, and this is what we're working with every day. So even in decolonization, we're still using colonial terms to decolonize, because the terms out there are to maintain control. So we often look for escapes or resolutions, but within the cultural conquests, idea of what escape is, which isn't what we, you know, culturally African, because, you know, we've had these institutions impose. America or the UK are very good examples, because, you know, they use words like justice, which is, you know, one of the ancient African principle standards that we have to live by to become human. They'll use words such as justice and peace and reciprocity and harmony, and have no understanding of what that is. So all the time, African people in the US or wherever are always fighting for these ancient beliefs, which have been handed down intergenerationally for thousands of years, really. But we, in order to make contact with them or to remember them, we have to have some kind of information to begin that process of memory. And so that's kept away from us, but it is an ongoing process that will never really die until African people are free. So the changes in idea of justice in the US are always fought for, but they are nothing like justice in the US or the UK will stop where it wishes to stop. It hasn't been completed, and it is not real justice. African people know what real justice is, because they have that ancient memory, and also it affects the lives and ability of African people to live better. So there's that knowledge, that ancient knowledge, which is always pushing the boundaries of European ideas, because they can never understand it, obviously, because once you have patriarchy, that is your first injustice. So while that is central to the culture, you can never know what justice is. You know, you can only really understand it if you have an example of what justice should be, which is the ancient African one, which is male-female reciprocity. People were judged in their judgment before, you know, when they have passed on what they've done. They were not judged on how they looked, whether they were tall or short or dark or light or anything. What have you produced that makes the world a better place? That is a judgment. That's a very, very ancient judgment. So all these things, you've got to be a man, you've got to be this, you know, all these hierarchies that divide us all in these ways are not part of judgment. It's who you are and what you've done in the world. As simple as that, but that's not what we do.
You know, the European control of the institutions, you know, and how has this affected, you know, African people, you know, as a result of this conquest? And, you know, in your book, there's a narrative, there's a her story, there's a story there about two sisters, you know, to do with their hair. One was invited to a party and one was not invited. And that's, you know, that struck a chord, you know, just based on their appearance. And that's within the same culture, you know, how we have come to perceive each other and how we have come to perceive ourselves. You know, there's, and then we accord ourselves level of superiority depending on the features that we have. Please, if you can touch on that a little bit.
Yes, that's the story of a light-skinned girl who had the straighter hair than her sister. And she was invited to a Lebanese family home party gathering. And her grandmother was looking after the two girls. And she said to her, you know, you should invite your sister. And she had a problem with that because she's not as good as she is because of her hair. So the grandmother cut her hair off. And you know, and showed them a cross on the lawn and showed them and told them the history of their people on the island, which I believe was Grenada, and talked about the numbers of people that had died to create an equality amongst people. And that because the grandmother had been party to all of that, the politics of the island, she wasn't going to have her children, her grandchildren separated merely by the color of skin and the type of hair texture that they had, because, you know, it meant that. And on the islands, people tell you this all the time in the Caribbean islands, and it's here everywhere where racism is. There are all these, this hierarchy. So even if you're a black person, so-called, the closer, the lighter your skin, the closer you are to beauty and to the European determination of what beauty is. And so, you know, we're always lightening our skins and you know, straightening our hair and doing all these types of skin changes to become human, really. That's all it is, because the epitome of humanity is the European man and woman. They are human, truly human, in the story, in the culture, which upholds their humanity but demonizes other people's humanity. And the darker you are, the more demonized, the more inferior, etc. So, you know, people try to get away from that by changing how they look. You know, so we're inside all of that. We're doing this, we're using European and Arabic ideas about our humanity to define who we are. And so, you know, when we look for escape from these situations, we look at their version of escape. Europeans' examples of becoming better, but they don't get outside Europeans being superior to everybody else and going through the idea of evolution and progress, which underpins many of these ideas that we use ourselves. But, you know, if we look at our progress, if we look at our evolution, you know, we can go back historically to look at the many things that we've accomplished compared to today. So we're going in retrograde motion. So obviously the idea of progress doesn't really suit us. You know, it suits the people that have constructed it, that have made it, that we've come from monkeys to white people. And that is the idea of progress. And, you know, when we use that ourselves, we use this ourselves because there's no information for us to understand that progress could be something completely different and that would be useful to us. We don't have the information there to see progress in another way.
Yes, I think this is one of the biggest scam, you know, the notion that someone will make you believe that you are less than, and you know, and people will assume that perspective, you know, almost like an invisible handcuff, invisible shackles. So you're already seeing yourself as less than. It's all here. That's why I'm hoping this podcast will speak to more people, you know, just enrich them, enrich their identity, you know, and make them believe in themselves. You know, there's so many things, even in most African countries, is, you know, bleaching, you know, hair, you know, nobody wants to wear their hair anymore. And it's very, very difficult to tell people this, you know, it's all in the mind, how you see things, how you see yourself, you know, and hopefully with time, we can be able, you know, thankfully, from the work that you do, you know, Professor Asante and all, people like you.
Yes, I have to mention Dr. Asante.
So
I'm his student, really. I mean, I work in the department with him. He's our chairperson. But really, I'm a student of Africology as well as a professor of Africology. And you can't know who you are until you have information. And so it scares people. Because, you know, to go back to African standards and ideas makes us think we're going to the primitive, because that's how evolution and progress has been structured in our heads. So we fear, we think, well, we've done nothing. We were primitives, you know. And even then, when you go into the primitive was not primitive. There never was such a thing. You know, you can go back 40,000 years to Khoisan people who knew how the planets moved, who knew how the moon moved, who knew, you know, and they recorded that. And we're supposed to see them as primitive. How many of us can do this? There's so much stuff that we've plagiarized from the people that came before, and then we've vanished. We've invisibilized the people that taught the people that came before. So it's a deep thing. So we have to go back to before these conquering religions and ideas and cultures have came, and that takes a lot of work. And, you know, we don't believe that's the way forward, because we've been taught that that is backward and primitive. So it's yeah, as you said.
You know, what I noticed is that, you know, most black people or most Africans don't like to talk about their culture, you know, publicly. You know, they don't like to talk about their culture publicly. They don't like to talk about, you know, being proud of their culture publicly. They're rather, you know, they're more likely to discuss like European culture, European countries or Ukraine, or delve into it. And, you know, but they shy away from discussing their culture. I don't know if they think that being proud of their culture means that they racist or they hate other people. But you can be proud of who you are, you know, without having those. So that's what I see. People shy away from talking about their culture, especially Black people and Africans. Why do you think that might be the case? Is this part of the impact that we're talking about?
Yeah, it's part of the cultural imposition of alien values and beliefs. You know, because we're thinking like the ones, like the conquerors, you know, we're thinking their way and trying to improve it. Obviously, we have to improve it as much as we can. But that's one part. We also have to have a vision of a different kind of future, because the future that's envisioned through the cultural orientation is that we will always be below those who are in control and conquered. And the blackest skinned people will be at the bottom of the hierarchy. This is what we've been historically shown. So clearly it's not those anti-African, anti-women, anti-black values ideas don't rest well. They are not realistic for us to go down that path. But, you know, there's so much fear that has been engendered in us that we will put down people who try to come up with those types of solutions, which is about, you know, what did African people do before conquest? You know, what foods were grown, like simple things like that. The foods that we're growing in different parts of Africa furnish the needs of the countries that are in control of those governing structures. You know, what did African people do before those governing structures? We have the ancient Kemetic governing structure from which all these later people used as a model for the structures we have today in governing. But those structures were about equalizing the role of women and men. And in fact, Diop does in one of his books, I think it's Black Africa, where he talks about bicameralism, which is where you will have a governing structure with two houses. One would be for women and one would be for men. But I mean, people can't imagine something like that. They just, you know, are used to all these men running things, you know, and I'm not anti-men in saying that. I'm just saying, look at the evidence. It can't possibly be balanced or structured in the interests of people, of humanity, when, you know, it's hierarchicalized in this way. And yet Diop has suggested that for Pan-Africanism, you know, as a modern way of bringing the ancient into now. So it's ironic that we're looking at ancient Kemet, which was broken into 42 nations who lived peacefully there. And that model is the one that the US uses, the UK, everything. We all use that very same African model. In the US, they have the Washington, it's a Tekken, it's an obelisk in Washington, the most powerful place in the world, governing structure in the world. The Washington Monument is actually an African monument, which is the Tekken. So there are different things that we model on Africa, but we remove Africa from these inventions.
And what usually happens is that Europeans will model a lot of things, you know, from Africa. They will take a lot of, cultural elements of Africa and repackage it, and then bring it back to Africa, and Africans will adopt it. You know, this is the story of Africa. This is the story of colonialism. Mm-hmm. This is the story of post-colonial structures. This is the story of, I was speaking to someone about, you know, energy security in Africa, and the fact that, crude oil will be extracted in Nigeria, and be exported out of the country, refined, and then Nigeria will buy it back. It blows my mind, you know.
Yeah. So
this is exactly what's happening in the cultural context, you know, and then in the material context as well. It's happening.
Right. It's all part of it. You know, the institutions that develop, that maintain this way of thinking and production and so on in the interests of the conquerors. There are hardly any people in Africa who are really benefiting from any of this at all.
You know, I'm sure you've touched a little bit on this, but, you know, what are the cultural ramifications for African peoples and others?
Well, we're using somebody else's beliefs to understand, to define who we are. The biggest identity that we need to develop from a Ethiopian perspective, from an Afrocentric perspective, Africological perspective, is the idea of its cultural identity. In this way, we will be looking for developing African cultural belief standards, ways of working, ways of developing institutions that meet the needs of people living in Africa, all African people, wherever they are. So it is that cultural identity that Job speaks about, that which means a commitment to developing ways that are going to speak to the people's needs, you know. And it's not to say that because you're white, so-called white and European, that all these needs are met, because it's not even healthy for Europeans. You know, so even though Europeans are privileged by being European or Arabic or Semitic, you know, in the race paradigm, even though people are privileged, that it doesn't mean that everybody believes this is the best way of existing. And you know, a future in which people can exist in a more balanced way, respect nature, consider sciences that are more fusion than friction, use resources that can benefit all people. These are really African ideas. And the ideas in the European thing is to take those ideas and talk about them and say, this is what we want, but have no avenue to ever get there. This is proven time and time again. But we do know that it existed before all this conquest, that people were fed. People had their spiritual systems. People took care of the rivers. Harmonized with nature, grew foods that could sustain people. That's happened. It's in the stories. First Nations people in the Americas, you know, even today in Brazil, First Nations people use, you know, their forests and their lands to produce the wealth that they need. And they have done amazing things. You know, they've also built pyramids and temples and whatever, you know. But what usually happens is the conqueror wants all these scientific things and reduces the people to nothing and creates a story about their inferiority. And you can read that in Job's work as well. I mean, it's absolutely true. But when he's talking about nation states, you can see the structures, how it happens, and, you know, how the real people, the truth seekers, the true people, those who try to live lives that would be helpful to everybody, to nature, understand the planets, have calendars, all these people are reduced to primitives in our heads. So we're using the same methods as Europeans and Arabs to see them that way. But that's not who they are any more than Africans. It's not. This is a false cultural perception in our heads. And because we don't have the knowledge of who we really are, it's hard to escape that, because we're always being made into what the conquerors want us to think we are.
Yeah, you know, I think this quote is attributed to Chinua Achebe, but I'm not sure exactly. You know, they say it goes by, you know, until lions tell their tale, you know, the story of the hunt will always glorify the hunter. So that's why we need, you know, this kind of platform. We have to tell our own story, you know, because nobody will tell our story for us. Even if they tell our story for us, they will tell it from their vantage point.
Exactly.
So we have to tell our own story. You know, Africans have to tell our own story. They don't have to shy away from telling their story, talking about their culture. You know, I'm trying to, like, kicking and screaming to tell people, you know, you don't have to shy away from that. You don't have to shy away from talking about it, because you have, like, a lot of, you know, white friends. You can still talk about your culture. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, where we cannot deny, you know, who we are. We cannot bury our heads in the sand. No matter how much you want to be European, you are African, you know, at the end of the day. So this is what I'm trying to, you know, get across. Hopefully people will start to, you know, absorb this and understand it more. And
well, Europeans are Africans.
Yes, exactly. But
they need teachers, you see.
Yes.
And we need to be able to get the information. We have to do the research and struggle for that information, which would be the episteme for African people. But of course, they benefit as well.
So
because it's based on truth. Sorry.
You know, with regards to race as a construct, you know, I was saying that we are all the same. Europeans, Africans, we're all the same, because we all originate from Africa. And the further away people migrate, the lighter their skin are, you know, migrate further away from the equator. So because the sunshine, you know, their skin doesn't need to protect them from the sunshine that much. So did you manage to establish the racial construct when that was created, you know, the idea of black and white and this, that race construct?
The reality is that everybody came out of Africa. So yeah. 70,000 years ago, everyone was dark-skinned, black person, and changed phenotypes, not races, but phenotypes. So we're 99.9 or whatever, 9% the same, but our differences are cultural, and this is what we have to try to understand. And that is very difficult for many of us, because we've been raised to believe in race, defining differences in humanity. And it all makes sense if you look at it. It's all, you know, white people who've done this and black people who've done that. You know, you can kind of sort of prove it, but it isn't genetically true. And when you begin to unravel the cultural perspective and begin to interrogate the history that we've been told, much of it is a falsification of reality, that some people are superior and some people are inferior, or all of these things which have been seen to be genetically true are always looking for genetic remedies. But when you look at culture, it means that people can change. If you're genetically something, you are always that thing in the mind. That's how we're taught. But with culture, you see, there is evidence to show that a human being can change, because it's the culture that is within the mind, the knowledge that feeds that culture, that enables people to become who they really are. You know, and some of us don't want to go that route, because it's easier to stay in the genetic one, because it makes so much sense.
Okay, so, you know, your book, you know, the said African mothers are the bearers of culture, makers of social change. Can you elaborate on that exactly for, you know, someone that is outside this concept? How so?
Yeah, I've really spoken a lot outside the book, you know, because I've spoken a lot about the things that I've learned since I wrote the book, because it's 20-something years old.
Yeah.
But I have the roots, the source of the later determinations that I've made. So it doesn't really take away. I'm still using Diop and an African way of looking at things. And what I've done is in the book is to bring mothers together who may not even be considered to be African in some ways or others, you know, people like myself. And that's why, you know, my own experience was really a very important part of this book, because my formative years were in Ghana and Nigeria. So it meant that when I came to the UK and went to school in the UK, I could see the madness of what was being said. I can't say that for children who were born in the UK and had to believe the story, but I came from the real thing, and so I knew that the story was wrong. I also had a European mother and an African father. And so when I was growing up, I was seen to be the product of a sort of hybrid devil makeup, a forbidden union between the one race and the other race. And so people were against my existence because of the coming together of these races, which shouldn't be breeding. And, you know, living in that kind of atmosphere where you're despised because you're a product of these breedings is a very strange place to be. And you know that, you know, in my case, you know, I had a father who was a brilliant thinker and a mother who also was a brilliant thinker, even though she came from a poor family. It was a family of people that all were sort of socialistic in their tendencies. And, you know, so my father should have been hanging off a tree as a monkey. And my mother was a prostitute because she came together with a monkey. So all these things in my head were ludicrous. You know, it challenged, you know, my whole family challenged all the ideas that were being perpetrated and given to us. So I really, writing this book was part of proving, in a way, that you can be African in your thinking and behavior, and culturally so, whatever you look like, if you believe in that culture, if you see the beauty of that culture, if you want to participate in that culture. So I had to realistically step outside the race paradigm. So, because it didn't make any sense, but then, you know, evidence shows that it's absolutely true. We are not races, we're phenotypes, which enables me to think, you know, well, I was onto something because I didn't believe what was said. So I was always a rebel. People, you know, at school, I hated the way that I was treated and looked at, you know, but people can't believe that, you know. They think, well, you're light-skinned, they must have loved you, but they didn't, because it was a forbidden union at that particular time that I was in it. So I've brought together different mothers from the Caribbean who are African, who come from situations like myself, but all care that their children should learn what it is to be an African. So that's what they all have in common. They're all part of that supplementary school movement or the full-time school movement in the States, because I've got mothers from the Caribbean that were both in the US and in the UK. I've got UK mothers who were born there and US mothers who came from families of enslaved people, as did the Caribbean people, Africans, all Africans, who had that need for their children to understand that. So that's what the book is about. And it's just about stories of the women and the struggles they went through as African women to get there, to work towards their children's developing consciousness, if you like.
So how can we move forward from here? How can we start to detangle this mess, so to speak? How do we move forward from here?
Well, I've always been a person who has thought that children need to be educated outside the school systems. Not to say don't go to the school system, but to say that there has to be another branch of knowledge, real knowledge, truth knowledge, that influences the children's thinking. Now, in the supplementary school in the UK, it was difficult because people thought that, look, if the children take time to learn these African things, they won't learn how to do their maths and English and so on. But what it does is, in learning about your African origins and legacy and heritage, one understands the structure one is in. And so one can move differently through the structure, knowing who one is. So it's not a wasted time at all. You can still achieve great things because you know how to do it, because you know what it's going to be, what will be the end product. And you know the pitfalls and all the things that are going to try to take you away from doing well in these schools. And there are full-time schools that do this, but I wrote this book based on my experience. It's called The Afrocentric School. It's got a picture of Arnie and Tutu having their hearts weighed against the feather of truth. And in there, you know, I've used the knowledge that all children should learn, but I focused on, you know, on African children, but any child can learn things that I've tried to put in here. And, you know, it's curriculum based. A lot of it is curriculum, but it's based on research, grounded research in Ghana. And, you know, with using children who are not literate in the main, and looking at what are they actually doing. And I've used the seven liberal arts from ancient Egypt to break the curriculum into sections, but also to recognize that the children who were not literate were actually doing amazing things. They were growing their own foods. They learned how to farm. They learned seasons. They learned the movements of the planets. You know, the types of sort of the types of, you know, they wove different designs. They learned how to welcome visitors, how to live, how to keep places, you know, to improve places. So they were tiny, just little children looking after each other. They learned mothering skills, compassion and love and care, you know, many of these things. What I did was take the skills that they learned and I put them in an academic framework so that when you're learning this, you're able to learn this. So that's the background.
I cannot tell you how important that book is. That's on my list, because why that book is important is that as part of this podcast, and I was telling Dr. Asante, as part of this podcast, I want to create a curriculum to add to what is already in African schools. Now, because I was saying that when I was in Nigeria, nobody taught me anything about Pan-Africanism. Nobody taught me anything about, you know, Africa. You know, how to seek this knowledge. And Dr. Santo also said about African studies and African diaspora studies.
Right.
You know, so this is what I would like to create. And that book, Afrocentric School, is the perfect, you know, perfect map, a guide for me to do this. And they have like age groups, right? I understand there's age groups,
Yes, it starts with about three, but it does look at children pre-birth even, you know, what their mothers say they're doing. But, you know, and Dr. Asante, of course, he has done that Afrocentric infusion for years in schools. So that state schools could include, that African information and help the children to realize their own identity, African identity, in a good way. So he's been doing it for years. And he has written books. I think he's been asked to rewrite a book now to bring it up to date, but he'd written school books for different ages. This book is different because it is for roughly from about 3 to 15 years old. And it just lays the groundwork. It's got curriculum in there, but you can build upon that. And you can, you know, it also talks about how to, you know, you could have a school in your sitting room for little kids that haven't even started going to school. You can have a school in an urban area. You could have a school on a favela. It can be useful in many ways. You know, you could follow it through page to page, or you could take some of it and then develop it your own way. So it has that, So Dr. Asante is definitely, he's been asked very recently to update some of the books that he produced years ago when nobody was even caring.
Yeah, so that's what I want to start doing in Africa. What I starting from Nigeria, starting from primary school, secondary school, and universities to start to infuse this type of studies. So that from a young age, people will start to become aware and comfortable in their culture, in their skin. It's very brilliant. Honestly, I cannot thank the work that you guys do, because you devote your life, decades, years and years and years looking into this, I really thank you and Dr. Asante and everyone who is in this field, because it is very, very beneficial to us to look up to that and then find ways to use it for good.
Yes, it's to be used for good, and it's not limited, you know, in that sense. I'm very honoured that you've found, that you have, just appreciate the ideas and not sort of thinking that it's rubbish, it's romanticism, it's this, it's that, because obviously, these are the things that are said. So thank you. It's, totally honored in your presence, and thank you.
Thank you. That's the end of interview. I was wondering, is there anything you would like to add before we end the podcast?
I think it's a difficult thing to do, to love Africa and to be African in that way, because we've got this sort of modernization thing in our heads. It's quite difficult. So, but I think it's like holding back the tide. It's going to, this is the direction that it must take, so people can stay inside the race paradigm. Or go inside the cultural paradigm and see the potential of what that is for humanity.
Dr. Nadov, I've officially moved from the race paradigm and comfortably in the cultural paradigm right now. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Wonderful. Okay. Wonderful seeing you. Thank you so much.
You too. Bye-bye. Have a good day.